Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 12:39 p.m. That is Pacific Summer Time. Today is May 17th and it's Friday, so it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Well, certainly what we've had in here this week has been an intensification of the trade war. China has very categorically said that there is no point in having additional talks until the USA is willing to compromise. That's almost a mirror of what President Trump has been saying, is that it was actions by the Chinese that brought down the negotiations in the first place. So there's a certain amount of tit-for-tat blame getting thrown across the Pacific. But the Chinese have been very clear in saying that they're going to do whatever is necessary to protect their economy. And that means they're going to devalue the currency. The question is, how much can they devalue the currency without causing a massive inflationary problem at home, and also without stoking a significant trend towards capital flight? It's also worth considering that a significant number of the most connected and highly placed people within the Chinese administration have probably already moved their money overseas. So this is much more of a consideration for your regular saver than it is for the elite. But when we look at the chart, the dollar is rallying back towards this 7 area, and 7 has been an area around which the communist administration have been willing to defend the renminbi over the course of the last few years. The weakest the renminbi ever traded at was at about 8.5 or in change. If it were to devalue by an additional 15%, we'd probably be in that region. When the USA imposed a 10% tariff, they devalued it by 10%. So there was a significant round of capital flight. It's worth considering that that was last year, and since then the currency has stabilized, but it has unwound all of the stabilization over the last while. I rather think that it's quite likely the Chinese will try and defend the 7 area for at least a while, but China has got some significant challenges in trying to contain the risk of capital flight. Now, when we look at the banking sector, well, they have been very keen to try and cut out shadow banking from the financial sector over the course of the last few years and have been largely successful. It's in these sort of big objective moves that China tends to be successful, because the word goes out that it's a very black and white statement. You're not allowed to lend anymore, so then that just gets shut off. What it is much more difficult to do in China is to have a nuanced approach to just about anything, because the orders that come down from on high tend to get to be very black and white statements. But one of the problems with devaluing the currency is that it makes everything that is imported more expensive, most particularly commodities. And commodity prices in China are rising, most particularly food items are starting to rise. Now, when food inflation becomes a significant issue, then that is something that is likely to cause civil unrest. That isn't something that anyone is really willing to countenance in a command and control economy like China. But one simple fact of the matter is that the USA is one of the biggest exporters of food commodities in the world. China is one of the biggest importers of food commodities that is no longer buying from the USA. They are trying to increase the quantity of soybeans under acreage, but that is going to come at the expense of something else, because China does not have even close to enough of territory to feed its population, and most particularly now that per capita consumption of calories has just about doubled over the course of the last 40 years. So That is a rather significant challenge for China to try and meet its food demand issues. And when we look at the banking sector, it is right now in the region of the trend mean, and it was in negative territory today. It definitely needs to bounce from the region of the trend mean to confirm that we're still in a demand-dominated environment, and that this state-sponsored bull market that began at the beginning of this year is still, I think, being supported by the government. The A-share index was down about 2% in here today. It's also right in the region of the trend mean. This is a pivotal area where it needs to find support. And so far, it has been able to hold the region of 3,000 and the region of the trend mean, but it will definitely need to continue to do so. When we think about what exactly is going on in China, well, they have got a significant overbuild problem in terms of the housing market. There's approximately a quarter of all dwellings are vacant, not only because there is a lot of them, but also because the prices are too high for people to afford the rents. So they just sit there vacant. There is no property tax in China, so there's no opportunity cost to continuing to hold these dwellings if all you need to do is to maintain their value. If, on the other hand, you get a recession in China, then that is going to put pressure on the property market. That would create some significant issues with bad loans, but at the moment, that could be contained provided they continue to have an absence of capital flight. It is capital flight is by far the biggest threat to China. Every other consideration can probably be managed, but capital flight is something that they are genuinely afraid of because of the risk to the wider economy that that would represent. If then we look at what's going on in terms of Wall Street, well, the S&P 500 has been pausing in the region of its peaks from 2018, and it was in negative territory so far in here today, and through the balance of this week, it has been in fact bouncing. It's right also in the region of the trend mean, and because we're in the region of the previous peaks, it is not at all surprising that we get at least some pause and consolidation. If we look at the markets, the market is clearly concluding that the USA will be the winner from the trade war. The S&P 500 is close to its highs. The dollar index continues to trade higher. And the bond market continues to attract buyers. So all US assets in here are attracting inward investment. That doesn't mean that every asset is marching higher. We have certainly had an uptick in volatility around the earnings season, which is to be expected. But certainly, also, if we look at the trend in terms of the government bond yield, it has lost momentum over the course of the last 6 years, but it failed to sustain the move above 3%, and now it is coming back down towards the middle of this range, but there's nothing on that chart to suggest that this downtrend is anything but consistent, and there is potential that we're going to see a further compression in yields. Part of the reason why we're seeing the compression in yields is because money is continuing to flow back into the USA and into all of those assets. There is also demand for safe haven assets, so that's an additional factor. Then, of course, you have the fact that German yields, for example, are in negative territory. They're at a new low in here today of negative 10 basis points. When we look at that trend on the Bund yield, it has still been reasonably consistent. There has been also a loss of momentum over the last 4 or 5 years, but it's still at the region of its all-time peak in price and low in yields. There is obviously the demand for these assets because of safe haven buying, because Europe still has very significant issues, and there is a obvious, there is also, I think, a conclusion that the German economy is highly leveraged to the global economy, and the global economy is experiencing a slowdown in growth at the minimum. When we think then about what about the Japanese yields? Well, they're at -5 basis points. They were at -10 as recently as March. This is not the first time that they've been negative. They were -20 basis points back in 2016. But there has also been a loss of momentum on this particular trend as well. I tuned into Jeff Gundlach's webcast over, I think it was on the 14th, and one of the points he was making was about the quantity of debt that is outstanding. There is a record quantity of government debt outstanding. That is something that is going to represent a challenge, both in terms of rolling it over, but also in terms of meeting the interest payments. And that represents a significant headwind over the longer term, not just the near term. Well, when we eventually get to a point where there are so many bonds that have been issued, and we're going to get to a point where everyone who wants them has probably got some, then there is the potential that we're going to have a pop upwards in yields. But there's no evidence of that just yet. In fact, we're seeing the opposite, that it's not so much that bond yields are rising in anticipation of a buyer's strike, but rather that buyers are continuing to fuel the momentum move, that they are concluding we're at the top of the interest rate cycle. When we look at the two-year yield, it was at a new contraction low in here this week. Now, it bounced a little off the lows in here today, and there is a short-term overbought condition on this, but this is still a consistent downtrend. If we are indeed at the top of the interest rate cycle, then generally speaking, that is representative of the bond market pricing in the next recession. So I thought it would be interesting to potentially look at the lead indicators for future recessions. There are a significant number of them. I remember I basically copy and pasted a piece out of an article I saw a couple of years ago about the kinds of things that Jim O'Neill looks for in predicting economic slowdowns. One of them was U.S. jobless claims. So if we look at some of these charts, then we can get an idea of exactly what's happening. Well, I think one of the most important of these indices is the jobless claims figure, because you can't very well have a recession without people losing their jobs. And that is just not the case in the USA right now. And that, I think, is one of the primary reasons why you're continuing to see outperformance by U.S. assets. It's because the USA is still expanding, that you still have almost record low unemployment, and the asset markets have not rolled over in a really big way. So that is one thing that is saying we're not quite ready for a global recession yet. But some of the other things that he looks at are, for example, the PMI data. So if we were to look at the ISM manufacturing data, it is trending downwards. It got right up to the upper side of this range that's persisted since 1986, and it is now turning downwards. Well, it is not below 50. You would need to see this below 50 in order to really suggest that a recession is imminent. But it is trending downwards. So at least this indicator tells us that we're late in the cycle, but that the cycle is not over. Now, when we look at China electricity, well, he looks at China consumption. I don't exactly know how to do that, but we can look at China electricity consumption. And when we look at this chart, it took a meaningful pullback at the beginning of this year. The last time it was updated was at the end of March. So that is in fact, the biggest pullback we've seen since at least 2010. I'll see if we can get more data. And it does not appear to be available. But that's a meaningful change. Now, the bigger question is whether it is going to pop on the upside the next time it's updated, which will probably be at the end of May. And the date we'll get will be for the end, or the data we get will be for the end of April. Now, so that's potentially suggestive of a slowdown in economic activity in China. This very much gels with the kind of environment that we had or that we witnessed in China last year. Generally speaking, Guangzhou, especially the old town, tends to be a happy-go-lucky kind of place, and it just had a different feel about it this last year. There was a pressure cooker environment, and when Mrs. Tracy was in China in April, she thought that there was almost an intensification of that feeling. So that is the kind of change in sentiment you get on the streets when economic activity is slowing down. So I think that is something that we should be paying attention to. Well, South Korea is one of the most open of all markets, and it is really quite exposed in terms of demand. Well, if we look at their exports, then the growth in exports peaked in 2011. It had a nice pop on the upside in 2016, but it has been trending down over the course of the last 2 years. So obviously, if we think, what is it that South Korea exports? Well, it's TVs, washing machines, cars, phones, and these are all consumer goods. So South Korean exports are a euphemism for consumer demand globally, and there has been a meaningful slowdown in terms of that. So that is also representative of the slowdown in the global economy. And then we can look at German business confidence. So that's another thing that is, I think, rather interesting, because it also got right up to a peak, the peaks that we haven't really seen surmounted since at least 1991, and now it is coming back down. Now, business confidence doesn't tend to be particularly confident in Germany by this index. It spends most of its time below zero. But I think the more important point right now is that it is trending down. It's at a new reaction low. And if we had to look at one reason why we have a negative yield on the Bund, well, it's got to be because business confidence is so low. And the economy is just about squeaking by at almost zero growth, but not quite negative. So these are some of the sort of the more big macro ways of looking at the market. Now, then there are the other kinds of things that we look at for predicting when we're going to have a recession. There are parts of the yield curve are inverted, but the 2 and 10 year spread has not inverted, and in fact it is still around the 20 basis point level. So now the question is whether it is going to contract further. That's certainly one issue to consider, that there is the potential that we're going to see this range trend down to the lower side following the failed upside break. it will really need to sustain a move back above 20 basis points in order to confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. So that is, I think, one consideration, but right now at least, it is not negative, and that suggests that there is potentially further to go in this bull market. Now, we won't just look at banking sectors, but I think it is important to pay attention to the fact that the S&P 500 banks index is still reasonably steady, although it has been pulling back for most of May so far, and that it is below the trend mean, but it is still holding the succession of higher reaction lows off the low in January. But that is still a downtrend since the beginning of 2018. So it is going to have to bounce from the 300-point level in order to demonstrate that the banking sector can do better from here. Banks are liquidity providers, and bull markets thrive on liquidity. So if banks are doing badly, it's because liquidity is drying up. So, and if liquidity is drying up against a background where the yield curve spread is very tight, well, that also tells us that we're potentially late in the cycle, but that the cycle may not yet be over. If, on the other hand, banks start trending down, then that would be that not just that we have tight liquidity, but that it is impinging upon their ability to make money. And if banks are not lending, making money, they're not lending. And if they're not lending, then not only do you have tight liquidity, but then credit starts to tighten up as well. And when you get both of those things, well, then those are the kinds of conditions that can create recessions. So banks are particularly interesting to pay attention to in an environment where liquidity is tightening. Now, I created this chart back in 2014, and it was a way to assess the way, or I guess the function of quantitative easing in boosting the not only the balance sheets of central banks, but thinking about quantitative easing and the mechanisms through which that massive money creation moved into the economy. What's particularly interesting in here this week is that it's at a new low. So I think that's a very important characteristic here. The primary reason it's at a new low is because the Federal Reserve is reducing the size of their balance sheet and the dollar is strong. The strength of the dollar makes the total assets of other central banks smaller. So that is leading to a contraction in the size of the global central bank balance sheet. And that is removing liquidity from the market. So while Wall Street is still reasonably steady, we know that liquidity is getting drained out of this market because of the strength of the dollar. So the size of the Fed's balance sheet is continuing to contract, and the pace of that contraction is still quite aggressive. So there is a clear line from the top left to the bottom right. They've taken approximately $400 billion out of circulation over the course of the last 12 months. They're not finished with it. It is going to persist until September. And that is one of the fundamental drivers behind the size of, or the, excuse me, the performance of the dollar. And the dollar index has bounced over the last five sessions, and it continues to hold its succession of higher reaction lows. I continue to think that it is quite likely we're going to see the dollar index trade up to 100. Well, what that suggests is that the euro is probably going to trade down to about 111 or 110 before we start to see meaningful support starting to come in. Well, that is also suggestive of the weakness that is evidenced in Europe. The fact that the German economy is just about holding on, that we if we look at global indicators, that global demand growth is moderating, not least because of the trade war and the imposition of tariffs not only on Chinese goods but Mexican, Canadian and European goods by the USA. The USA has been the consumer of the world's goods for decades. There has and over that time, a significant reliance on that demand has fed the national champions of a significant number of countries. Now that we have the Chinese economy slowing, the potential for inflationary pressures to rise, particularly in China as a result of the weakness of their currency, the potential for tariffs to be imposed on an additional $300 billion worth of Chinese exports, that raises the prospect of inflationary pressures starting to rise in the USA. The one benefit the USA has, though, is that they have the opportunity to shop around. And if China doesn't want to play ball on the global stage, then they have the opportunity to support manufacturing in other countries, particularly India and Vietnam. Vietnam is also a communist state, but it is not a communist state like Xi Jinping's communism, but rather more like Deng Xiaoping's communism. In other words, this is more like a communist party from the 1980s. The Vietnamese Communist Party does not have global ambitions. They don't want to have a global empire. They're willing to play along, to get along, and just keep their heads down and make money. That was very much what Deng advocated, which was to say, stay quiet and hide your strength. And that is the exact policy that Jiang Zemin also followed, which was just to stay quiet and make money. And it's been abandoned by Xi Jinping. So that is the primary reason why there is this uptick in geopolitical conflict. The West was reasonably happy and are tolerant of China's advance, provided they didn't exhibit global ambitions to be in charge. They are now doing that, and that is why I think we are seeing this trade war. The ultimate aim of the trade war is to stop China's global ambitions. If that means trying to force a recession in China's economy, I think the conclusion has been reached that that is a necessary condition. So that is almost exactly the same playbook that was used on Russia. It wasn't military might that brought down the USSR, it was economic might. And the imposition of tariffs is a potential way of thinking about that. One of the things I thought was interesting was Steve Bannon writing in the Washington Post said, "We're in an economic war with China. It's futile to compromise." Well, if you're in an economic war, what are the aims of that war? Well, obviously, one is to protect your own economy or to boost your own economy, but the other, of course, would be to beggar thy neighbor. And that would appear to be also one of the ambitions that is certainly going on in terms of this trade war. With global liquidity contracting to new reaction lows, that is a potential lead indicator for future volatility. So it is, I think, particularly important that indices like the S&P 500 and the Nasdaq continue to hold the region of their trend means. When you look at the consistency of the trend in the Nasdaq, it rallied really very impressively. The pace of the advance picked up, particularly from 2017 through to the peak in 2018. and in early 2018 than it had a somewhat larger pullback, but certainly not a larger pullback than we saw in 2015 or 2016. So we could argue that that was still reasonably consistent and it was from a much higher price level. It then moved on to new highs, and if it had held the 7,000 level following that pullback from the peak in August, then this would have still been a consistent trend. But it didn't. It had a much larger pullback. On just on the simple chart over the last decade, this is the, by far the largest pullback we've seen. Then it pushed on to new high ground. And now the big question is whether the region of the trend mean is going to hold on this occasion. If we get a failed upside break here and it pulls back below the trend mean, then it's, I think, probably going to be rather difficult to push back up above the trend mean. And we will be in, I think, arguably top formation development. So there is the real, I think this is one of the times to be particularly vigilant and to pay particular attention to the consistency of trends. Something that we see at major tops is that consistent trends lose their consistency at the penultimate high. So if this is not the peak, then there is potential for an additional leg on the upside. Well, what is it that could drive that leg on the upside? Well, I have a feeling that it's going to have to be dollar weakness. That if the dollar continues to strengthen, then that is going to suck money into the US markets. That's certainly true. But we're going to have to see at least some additional liquidity coming into the market. And the dollar's rally right now is sucking liquidity out of the global economy. Well, what that in the near term has potential to do is to further boost US exceptionalism in terms of performance. Well, then if we look at the global deficit chart, what we're presented with there is an index that tends to move around a lot, and we haven't had any real movement over the last week. So we haven't had new statistics coming out. As recently as April, the market had priced in that we had at least an additional $800 billion of stimulus brought into this market. Now, it has come contracted with the last readings down to about $500 billion. But the size of the Fed's balance sheet has contracted by $400 billion in the last year, whereas since the beginning of 2018, an additional almost $600 to $700 billion has been created from fiscal stimulus. Well, if we're looking for a reason why the market has been able to go sideways, it's because of that fiscal stimulus. It's because the quantity of money that governments have been willing to spend through deficits has outweighed the money that has been taken out of circulation through the reduction in the size of central bank balance sheets. I think the other important market to pay particular attention to as a harbinger for trouble in the global economy is oil. Well, oil prices bounced in here this week, although they did finish out today in negative territory. They're right in the region of the trend mean. The reason that they bounced over the course of a few days in the middle of this week was because of Iran targeting both pipelines and supertankers belonging to Saudi Arabia. Well, there is the possibility that the region is going to become more volatile, and that because of, and I think it is quite clear that one of the reasons why the Trump administration has imposed sanctions on Iran is to damage the prospects for China. Iran supplies a great deal of oil to China, and they can't very well replace it. So that represents a challenge. One of the additional reasons why the Trump administration has become more interested in what's going on in Venezuela over the course of the last 8 or 9 months is also because of the trade war, because China gets a substantial amount of its oil from Venezuela and has significant investments in the country. Well, all of these factors are suggesting that the USA is willing to make geopolitical statements wherever it is in their interests to boost the trade negotiations. Well, as long as oil's price is holding those lows put in at the beginning of this month below the $70 area, it's still in a reasonably consistent environment. If we get geopolitical tensions picking up and potentially even a hot war between Saudi Arabia and Iran, then we'll have a different story, and it is really only a clear supply shock is going to really sustain oil prices above the $85 area. But that would require a war to start. If we were to see oil prices surging higher, then that would be shaving points off of global economic growth at a time when growth is already slowing. So that is also a lead indicator for future recessions. Then, when we look at other sectors that tend to be defensive, it's usually defensive sectors do well in the latter stages of a bull market because people are starting to move out of growth and into things that can help them protect their wealth. So utilities are now at new highs. And if we look at this index on an historical basis, this has been a record move that utilities have been able to perform because yields have been contracting. So that's a rather significant factor. Consumer staples is also doing reasonably well in here and is right in the region of its peak. Now we are likely to get some additional consolidation here, but at least it's not at the lower side of this range. Consumer staples are not quite as defensive as utilities, and they do have some more growth attached because of exposure to the global middle class. There is, of course, the question whether we're going to have the ability of these kinds of companies to sell on a global basis if the trade war persists. There is likely to be a boycott of European or at least US products in China during this trade war process. That is a particular risk to companies like Apple. And I'm not typing very effectively. So Apple prices are right now in the region of the trend mean and pulled back over the course of the last 3 weeks. And Tesla might be building a factory in China, but there are 500 battery factories, or excuse me, electric car companies in China. That's a sector that's hanging out for some rationalization, but the other fact is that Tesla's cars seem to be going on fire with surprising regularity, so that is leading to a further contraction in the price. Now it's coming down to the $200 area, so and there is certainly a short-term oversold condition. So now the question is, are we going to get a bounce from this area, and will it be in a dynamic enough manner to suggest that we're back in a demand-dominated environment? A couple of the interesting things that Tesla is doing is trying to shake up the insurance market, and that's, I think, a very important consideration because insurance is one of the highest margin businesses out there, and they also have I think the potential for autonomous vehicles. If we're thinking about autonomous vehicles, well, Tesla's cars are also killing people with their self-driving technology, so that's not especially good news. Google has been much less aggressive in pushing the technology, but they are arguably the leaders in the sector, and the price is currently in the region of the trend mean, and it was in negative territory in here today, but that was a very powerful upper dynamic we saw 2 days ago. One factor that is linking consumer staples with the technology sector has been the adoption of a subscription business model. And that is a factor for companies like Google. It's also a factor for companies like Apple as they continue to attract additional interest. Then when we think about the fact that companies like Cisco adopted a subscription business model, so they are really moving stronger in a very aggressive manner. I'm just going to take a pause to cough. Just bear with me for a moment. So when we then look at Cisco, it's a very clear upper dynamic that we saw this week on stronger earnings. When we look at other companies that are adopting subscription business models, what they're clearly doing is having this relative performance. Netflix might not be making profits, but it has certainly been able to hold on to the majority of its performance. Well, that is clearly moving to an environment which is creating a beneficial factor in terms of demand. Now, this is, I think, a very significant point, because we are at a section here where there is demand for consumer goods, there is demand for utilities, and the continued performance that we're getting from the subscription business models, they represent the clear outperformers. But the subscription business model is highly linked to the health of the consumer. It's also linked to the health of the corporate sector. And if the global economy, it turns downwards, well, the incremental costs of subscriptions versus outright payments or purchases is going to give them some protection, but the proliferation of the subscriptions means that subscriptions do get cancelled in a recession. Then you have the fact that if we do get a recessionary environment, then that will also impact consumer demand. Its utilities are highly defensive, and their performance is suggestive of the latter stages of a bull market. What is interesting too is that tobacco has not been performing. That is despite the fact that it is an addictive quality and that it does tend to do well in the latter stages of a bull market. Well, it is not doing well right now. It is still trending downwards. The yield on Imperial brands right now is nearly 10%. So there is, and you can also see that there is significant dividend growth. Well, when we look at that yield, the last time we saw yields like this on the sector was in 1998. Obviously, there are risks in the growth of the vaping market, and also in the fact that that is stealing market share from the established tobacco companies. But these are very deeply oversold, and it would not at all be surprising that they start to outperform in the latter stages of a bull market, not least because things have to be pretty dire before the majority of investors would even consider buying a tobacco company. They really are persona non grata for the vast majority of people. Then the drinks sector is also really quite defensive and also selling an addictive product. And Diageo is doing really very well at present and is really quite overextended relative to the trend mean right now. And there has been a meaningful uptick in the pace of the advance. Then when we look at, for example, McDonald's or Disney, well, Disney has got its growth potential from the adoption of streaming and the acquisition of the rest of Hulu, but that was a very emphatic breakout. When we think about coffee and the consumption of coffee, it also has addictive characteristics, and Starbucks continues to march higher. But what this is really very clearly evidencing for us is that investors are clearly favoring the kinds of companies that have got highly predictable cash flows. That is equally true of these consumer staples, consumer discretionary, that are more or less staple, and the subscription business model, because that subscription business model has transformed the cash flows of what were once highly cyclical technology companies into highly predictable cash flows. So that's, I think, one of the most important factors that we have in here right now. We are late in the cycle, and it is defensive sectors do best, but it has been the creation of the streamlined cash flows for growth companies that have given them defensive characteristics that is helping to promote them. Well, if we're thinking about where is there evidence of malinvestment? Where is there evidence of clearly egregious activity and the swelling of, I guess, one of the better ways to say it would be, where is it that we have seen the most aggressive forecasts for future growth? Well, it's in the private sector. It's in these companies that are coming to market right now. Uber, for example, just went straight down off its IPO, and that was even after they successfully listed it at the lower range of the IPO. And I think that was one of the reasons why people were so aggressively shorting Lyft. So Lyft also had a failed IPO, and it was aggressively shorted down to its lows quite recently in an effort to try and get Uber down to the lower side of its IPO range. Then, when we look at, for example, Pinterest, they had one of the more successful IPOs. And even they came through with a guidance in here over the last few days that was well below what people were hoping for. The WeWork company, or the what they're now calling the We company, is coming up for an IPO, and for all intents and purposes, it is a real estate office company. Now, they have nice offices and they give away free beer, but free beer is not the kind of thing that justifies a $50 billion valuation. So that's where we have this very clear trend of people falling over themselves to pay ever higher sums for investments. And now that these companies are starting to come to market, they are being seen through the lens of investors who see companies that have got very little prospect of making profits over not just the short term, but ever. The simple fact is that when you look at a company that is doing one thing, but then they try, for example, like Uber, everyone associates Uber with ride hailing, and yet what they're trying to sell themselves as is a food delivery service. Well, companies like Domino's do pizza delivery, and they're not given the kind of valuation that Uber has. So why on earth would anybody want to pay that for these types of companies? And I think that is where the greatest evidence of bubbly activity is in this cycle. But it's not in the listed market. It is, however, in the private equity market, and private equity firms have been investing in these companies at ever higher levels. Then, in the last couple of weeks, we've seen that the Vision Fund, which is only 18 months in evidence, is now looking at potentially having an IPO. They went into companies like WeWork and Uber not so early, and now they're looking to get out of the business. So that is also an indication that people are starting to look at the valuations in the private sector and are really starting to get a little bit antsy about their positions. But again, that is not the public sector. And in the public sector, we just are going to see these companies coming in at lower valuations. That also represents a source of additional supply. But obviously, if they come in at lower valuations, then that will be less supply than it might otherwise have been. Nonetheless, we need to pay particular attention to the consistency of trends around this period. One of the major benefits of the massive sources of liquidity that have entered the market over the course of the last year or the last decade have been the kind of money that has been poured into space technology and the evolution of autonomous vehicles and ride hailing and the sharing economy. And those are going to have meaningful effects on global productivity over the long term, but not before we see some of those companies go bust. So I think that is certainly one of the factors that is worth keeping in mind. It's also worth considering that Tesla was also one of those companies, and now the share price is coming down rather violently. Well, it is going to have to find support around that $200 area if we're to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside or to recovery. If I try to synthesize everything we've been talking about, I think that the trade war is not over, that there is the potential for a deal because Donald Trump wants to get re-elected. But it's really a question of whether he thinks that he has a better chance of being re-elected if he is appealing to his base or appealing to their wallets. So what we could see is an easing of political tensions over the course of the next 18 months that could then fuel an additional run on the upside, but that's a best case scenario, and it is contingent on markets holding the region of their trend means. There is the potential that the stock market does represent a Trump put, and he will be more willing to compromise if the stock market pulls back. If we continue to see yields compressing, particularly below the levels that we've seen recently, then that's a clear vote that the bond market is pricing in not just interest rate pauses, but an interest rate cut. I've been thinking over the course of the last week, why is it that bond investors tend to be better at predicting recessions than stock markets? And I think it's primarily because the bond market is more about buying, and the equity markets, the people writing research in the equity markets, are mostly about trying to sell you stock. Well, the seller is always going to have a more rosy picture. The buyer is always going to have caveat emptor in the back of their minds. So I think it is important to pay attention to what the bond market is telling us. And the bond market is at a new all-time high in terms of total performance. So the clear risk is that we are flirting with a global slowdown. We are not yet at a global slowdown, but we can't say that it is too far away either. So this is the time to be particularly vigilant about the performance of the stock market. And against that background, gold prices have been steady, but the most recent dynamics are downwards. It is right in the region of the trend mean. If it can hold this level, that would be quite benign. But the bigger picture is that it has been ranging for 6 years and remains in that range. It's going to have to sustain a move above the $1,380 level in order to, or I think let's call it $1,400, to confirm we're back in a demand-dominated environment. That would also be contingent on the dollar weakening. And the dollar is going to need a reason to weaken. And the Federal Reserve stopping reducing the size of its balance sheet would be a meaningful event in terms of the dollar. I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I wish all the best to all of you.